Brigadier Page, Reel 6.
The German artillery, I think on the whole, changed very little in actual type of gun. I mean, the Pipsqueak, their field gun, which was a 77mm, invariably known as the Pipsqueak, and they had a 4.2-inch height, so very like our 4.5, which was an effective gun. They had a very horrible 5.9, 150mm howitzer, and they had that was their most unpleasant gun of all, we always thought. There was a bigger one, a 2.40cm, an 8-inch, which was sometimes fired at us. But we all hated the 5.9. In fact, the whole British Army hated the 5.9 more than anything else, I think. One thing about the 5.9 was, I think, it undoubtedly had more effective ammunition than we did at the beginning. Our ammunition improved. But strange to say, I don't remember any sort of brand new form of gun arriving from the Germans. Of course, the Germans did do a great deal of gas shelling. They introduced gas from canisters, and they introduced gas shelling. They didn't seem to use smoke, and as far as I remember, I don't think we used smoke very much. But I don't think their material altered greatly. I think at the time of in April 1917, they had gone purely in for putting as much artillery and as much ammunition they could, pouring it into area strass over the whole area. And it was pretty soul-destroying for the recipient, because he could never find a safe area to go to. By 1918, the Germans had produced on the Western Front the similar type of crash bombardment, that's what we would now call a blitz, on the 21st of March, which was again organized by the same German General Bruckmüller, who had organized one in Riga a year before, and that was remarkably effective. It was not so much a creeping barrage, a rolling barrage, as we went in for. It was more of what was later called concentrations of fire on various points. But we, practically throughout the war, we relied on the creeping barrage, and that which was fired by the field guns, the 18-pounders, and the only way it was altered was if the ground was very bad in the salient, it probably advanced only 100 yards in 8 minutes. And if it was down in dry land down in the south, it probably advanced 100 yards in 3 or 4 minutes. But really, for the field gunners, during attacks, it was the creeping barrage was the common means of support. And there was really a curtain of fire right along the whole front. You could see it. You could get the OP. You could see how solid the curtain was. And the 4.5s used to fire a little further ahead than the 18-pounders, because they had a bigger back blast. They were inclined to blow their large base plates back if you were within about 300 or 400 yards of them. The medium artillery before an attack, during the opening of an attack, would be used for special tasks, like counter battery, which it might have been dealt with the night before, or and on the strong points, and all that kind of thing. And the heavy artillery, I don't know, that was blasting off into the distance, long range.
In 1916 and 1917, perhaps we could just bring this particular aspect up to the end of the war, and perhaps you could summarise your feelings about the advances which had been made by the end of the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, the core artillery operations squadrons had really four main duties. They had observation in general, they had photo recce, they had what was called RTOB, observation for the artillery, and in times of active operations, they had contact patrols. Contact patrols were aeroplanes which flew up and down the front and actually watched and was reported on the where the front line was, and the leading infantry fired smoke signals and things like that. But that was only a sort of the odd job that was done during active operations. The corps squadrons had terrible casualties because, of course, they were always circling around the same bit of sky at about the same height and at about probably not more than 80 miles an hour. And any form of observation, of course, demanded flying on set courses and all that kind of thing. And they had took a great bashing. It's interesting to note that we talk about the observer in an aircraft, but in point of fact, in army operational squadrons, the pilot did the work. The observer sat in the back seat with his Lewis gun and tried to protect himself or protect them from aeroplanes coming on their tails. Now, arty observation was basically concerned with locating active gun positions and calling for and observing fire from medium batteries, which were normally allotted to such tasks, and for doing specially pre-arranged shoot. Now, the counter-battery staff had very fine records, and they put them on the maps, and they were all regularly circulated. So we knew, in our OPs, as well as the airmen up above, they knew where batteries' positions were. They were shown on the map. They might know whether they were occupied or not, unless they saw the battery firing. One job was, the RTOB, was to keep a sort of general view for the counter-battery staff of what guns were in action. And if the RTOB pilot saw position number 99 in action, he sent quickly GNF 99, and everyone knew exactly what that meant. It meant that position number 99 was actually firing GNF gun now firing, and they would be occupied. Well, those were the ordinary sort of day-to-day work. And the other type of shoot was the pre-arranged shoot, which need a good deal of preparations. Now, to start with, the communications were very difficult. The aircraft pilot had a one-way transmitter, which he could send to the battery. The battery had a one-way receiver, so they could receive the pilot's signals, but they couldn't send back to him. They, at the battery, had ground strips in which they could put out simple signals, X's and L's and things like that, which meant we're ready to engage or go home, finish something, various things. The ground strip was the only way the battery could communicate with the pilot. Well, the normal drill was that the pilot should come up overnight and see the battery and get things worked out, and then he would leave a tender with the receiving set to use for the battery next day. Then, at the prearranged time in the morning, he would arrive overhead, he'd circle the battery, would send down the battery call and say he was ready to observe. The battery would put out the ground strip, which meant they were ready to fire. And the pilot, when ready, would signal fire. And he would do single gun ranging. And the pilot used to fly in a figure of eight, circling over the battery, round over the target, and back again, in a figure of eight all the time. And he being there overnight, he knew the approximate time of flight, so he knew that when he sent far, and he could see the gun go off afterward, he'd say, well, I've got to wait 20 seconds, and I should see the burst. And so he then reported by the clock code. The pilot reported by the clock code, which I think was probably still being used in the Second War, in that you assumed a clock face with the 12 o'clock facing north, and then you had rings round at 100-yard intervals, A, B, C, D, E. So when the pilot saw around and he reported down 3 o'clock E, you would say, oh, that is 500 yards east, isn't it? Yes, 500 yards east. It was all done on the clock code, and it was quite good with practice batteries. But you can see, when he finally got a hit, he used to send the good okay, but one didn't often get that, I'm afraid. It was obviously a slow business, but I mean, he was doing accurate ranging on a battery or on some strong points and so forth, and it couldn't be rushed. And it probably had to be done with one gun only, or perhaps a section of two guns. But when the battery commander was satisfied that he'd got the range pretty good, the battery commander would then go to fire for effect, and from then onwards, the pilot would merely report in sort of general times, MOK, mostly OK, or mostly plus, that sort of thing. An experienced pilot and a practiced battery could obtain very good results, but it was a system, I think, best left to the experts of the medium batteries, who did most of it. And field batteries were not often given the chance to do prearranged shoots. For one thing was, it was not easy to observe from the air, or even from an OP, but not easy to observe a small HE burst of an 18-pounder, or even of the 4-5 Howe. And at that time, there was no smoke. In the Second War, I think one had plenty of smoke, and one can always range with smoke and recognize one's appropriate color. But at our time, we had very great, even in our OPs, we had very great trouble in observing some of our fire. It improved later on, you know, with the 106 fuse, which I've already mentioned, which gave a very much better burst. But on the whole, the 18-pounder and the 4-5 Howe, the crump was not big enough for the airmen really to spot well, I think. And I think it was wisely left medium batteries to do this prearranged shoots.